Hi, you guys. My name's Carla Rowland. I'm an alcoholic. God, if just one of those things is true, you know? Oh, yeah, thank you.
Important time.
The timer, always good to know when you got to shut up. I never used to know that. I still don't sometimes. Thank you. So, first of all, I want to thank the group for having me. I'm at a blank. Was it Kathy or was it Meredith who invited me out here to Yona? It was Yona. Where is Yona? Yona's home with a sick baby. So it was Yona who called me, and I knew Kathy, I knew Meredith, and I know a few of you. So I'm really delighted just to get to be back out here. It feels very comfortable and exciting at the same time. So delighted to be here, and it's still always a privilege to be able to do anything in a meeting or a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope I never ever take that for granted. My sobriety date, September 25th, 1987. And before that, I never did anything 32 years in a row on purpose that was of any value. You know, I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get a life, to learn how to live a real life with any kind of purpose at all. And it wasn't like I didn't have spiritual awakenings before that. It wasn't like I didn't believe in God. It wasn't, but I just couldn't get it all together. And I'm one of those, you know, young drinkers. I started when I was young, and when I discovered what alcohol would do for me, I let it. Why wouldn't I? I mean, it became my spirituality. It became my growing up muscle. It became the thing that made me feel buffered from you and the thing that made me feel connected to you all at the same time. Why wouldn't I drink that? And again, like I said, it wasn't like I didn't believe in God, but man, a drink is so much quicker than a prayer, you know. I can take a drink, I can pray and ask for God's will and try to figure out what all that stuff is, or I can have a drink and feel okay right now, you know. And funny enough, I didn't know that alcohol only does that for about 10% of the population. It just does not do that for 90% of the population of the world. Isn't that interesting? I didn't know that. I thought everybody in the bar drank like I did. I got mad at the end, toward the end, when my bar pals would tell me I might be one of those people who just shouldn't drink. That would make me mad because I'd think we were all in the same place here, you know. I think the best definition or description of alcoholism is in the big book on page 44. In the first paragraph where it says, I think we have made clear in the previous pages, I'm going to paraphrase, I think we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If when you honestly want to find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience will conquer. And I say twofold illness. It works for me. I've got this allergy of the body that happens when I'm drinking. I've got this obsession of the mind for alcohol that happens when I'm not. And I treat the spirit and I get better. We've got the spiritual solution for this mental and physical problem. And the reason I say that, the reason that I experience it that way for me is that there is nothing, there is a other people, non-alcoholics get sad. Non-alcoholics have spiritual dark nights of the soul. Non-alcoholics have all of those things. But what happens when they pick up a drink, what happens when I pick up a drink does not happen to them or for them. It just doesn't. It's different. And I still get entertained at non-alcoholic drinking. They just don't care. I may finish this water. I may finish this water during this talk. I may not. If it was a beer, if it was a bottle of Johnny Walker, any color, it'd be gone. And I'd be asking for more before this talk was over. It's just different. And I couldn't spring that trap. Alcohol worked so well for me for so long, even with all the trouble that it caused, that it was just hard to let go. Hence that portion in chapter 3, more about alcoholism, that we see that I just loved when they would read that in the first meetings I went to. You know, when I got to AA, and at first it was July in 1987, because I had to drink one more time in 89 days, but I got here in July, and I weighed 110 pounds. I had a distended liver. I felt like if you blew on me, I'd turn to dust. I was getting ready to lose my daughter again. I was living indoors, but not for long. You know, my husband and I were settling our arguments with a shotgun. Whoever got to the gun first won. And that's what we look like. And that's just an overview. You know, you're not going to get to hear 62 years of living before and after sobriety in this hour. You know, it's not some cheap episode of Law and Order, you know, where you get a Law and Order and then boom, you're good. You know, it's not like this. So you're going to get the low lights, really. And when I got to AA, I thought it was very important to try to figure out why I'm an alcoholic, you know, and God, even in this day, all these years later, there's so much information coming at us, you know, and so much available, you know, and I think a lot, it's just my opinion, I have no way of proving it, but I think a lot of people are doing, because AA is so available, a lot of people are doing their first step, their pre-first step stuff in AA. You know, more people are availing themselves of AA and yet not quite getting it for a while. And so whatever, it doesn't mean anything except, you know, there's just a lot of information coming at us. And so, but when I was new, I was trying to figure out why I'm an alcoholic. And was it my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family? You know, you hear a lot about trauma these days, you know, trauma. And I'm not, you know, I'm not dissing trauma. Trauma happens, but it just, you know, you know, when you make that the reason that for being and the reason that I am how I am, and then I've got no hope, you know. So, you know, and what I discovered in AA is that'll give you an inventory, but it didn't make me alcoholic. And I know that because I've paid attention over the years, and I began to learn and notice that people like my husband, who lived charmed childhoods, you know, I mean, this guy grew up in his family. Doug. You know, he grew up singing, his family sang together and loved each other. And his father painted the family pickup the color of his high school, you know what I mean? It was that family. And after we've had a little gathering, you know, I still walk away with a little bit of a sugar headache, you know what I mean? Because it's just so sweet. And yet, he sits right next to me in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, always has. Why? Because alcohol did exactly foreign to him what it did foreign to me. And all by himself, he couldn't spring that trap either. So I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I'm just glad that I finally know that I am. And I spent a few years there, you know, I didn't even realize I was doing it. Now, I've never bellied up to a bar saying, okay, Joe, you know, the obsession to drink alcohol has been on me all day. So you better just hit me with one or two shots, you know, but be careful because that phenomenon of craving is going to kick in and we're not really going to understand if I'm going to have two or 22. I never said that. I never knew that was happening. Never, ever knew that that was happening. I had to come here to learn any of that. All I knew is that toward the end there, I didn't want it to be the alcohol that was going to have to go. And you know, it's closing in. I know, like our book says, you know, we suspect somewhere along the line that we're down for the count. But damn it, it can't be the alcohol. Oh. Because with all the trouble that it caused, it was still my salvation. It was still the only thing, no matter how small that window of relief got, it was still the answer. So, I don't know, I'm just glad that I know that I am. And, I've always believed in God, too. You know, like, since I was a small child, I'd lay in my room and I would contemplate and I would wonder, you know, what is this? What is this great power that runs in and around and through us? There's something. But I could never maintain contact. I could make contact sometime. I couldn't maintain it. You know, and when I started to drink, man, it filled me up. Alcohol was that great substitute. It was a sufficient substitute for a while. And I was born into a Southern Baptist family, and that religion worked very well for my mother till the day she died 11 years ago. She loved it. She had faith in it. She utilized it. She was great. I'm not somebody you're going to hear that you got to choose between being spiritual or religious. I think you can be both. I don't, I'm not, you know, it's cute to say, oh, I'm a recovering whatever, Baptist or Catholic or whatever, but I just don't think that that's really been the problem. I think it's, again, the forest for the trees thing. You know, I can't criticize a whole institution because of a few people. Can happen in AA too. We got spiritual pride galore in here. We've got everything you could want, all in AA too. But you know, so I tried the Southern Baptist thing, and I tried being a Catholic for a couple weeks in the fourth grade. You know, I was attracted to the ceremony and the ritual. I thought that was pretty cool. I don't think that spiritual thirst is a dilemma. I don't think spiritual thirst is a malady on its own, on its face. It's what we quenched it with that became the deal, and we can quench it with a lot of counterfeit stuff. For me, alcohol worked. You know, a lot of we're not the only people who experience miracles. I think it's really funny that we're people who felt guilty and hope God doesn't find us, and we never knew who God was or any of that stuff, and Jesus, you know, we're just so guilty, and then we get to AA, and 3 months later, too bad they don't have what we have. You know, I got to remind people sometimes, and myself as well, you know, that we rent from them. So they've been okay. They're allowed to own property. So they've been kind of spiritually set. Nobody's perfect. There's no human being on earth is perfect. But I used to, you know, quench my human condition with alcohol, and for me as an alcoholic, it worked. You know, like I said, I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in the fourth grade, and then my mom had this friend who was into witchcraft, and so I started burning black candles and praying to the other guy for a while, you know, just hedging my bets, really. I just wanted to be on the side that was winning, you know, and then the television series Kung Fu came out. I know some of you are old enough to remember that show. David Carradine, oddly enough, ironically, played a Buddhist priest named Kane. And now this guy was spiritual. You know, he was tough. He walked the Wild West in bare feet, nothing but the clothes on his back, a little bag on his belt. I don't know what was in that bag, but he looked pretty peaceful. And he'd walk from town to town, and because he looked different, he'd be met by a whole group of guys, hostile. And because he looked different, they'd come at him and assault him verbally, and he would stand there ever so elegantly, and pearls of wisdom, just a couple sentences, would just roll off his tongue. And he'd watch their faces change, and they'd go off to help people. And I thought, oh my God, there's power in that, isn't there? There's real power in that. And don't we know power when we see it? Don't we know real power when we see it? I might not be able to get at it or utilize it, but I know it when I see it. And I wanted that home. And then he'd walk to another town, and because he looked different, hostile guys coming at him. This time they'd assault him physically. And when they did that, he kicked their ass. And I wanted what he had. He seemed to me to be the perfect personification of strength and serenity all rolled up into one guy. And there's power in that, isn't there? Just power. Oh. And what was going on in my family was just like that. I just wish I could, you know, my stepfather was violent, and I just wish that I could just shoot him just in one swoop, just say something or be able to, you know, and solve it. And I couldn't. And then school was happening. There was a lot of violent stuff going on at school, and didn't I want that power? And oh my God. And little by little, I began to realize what alcohol would do for me. My first drinks were sporadic, and I didn't, you know, go running for the bar after my first or second drink, but gradually I began to. It was about, I guess it was that summer between sixth and seventh grade, I really started to understand what alcohol would do for me, and it was after a game of spin the bottle, and I know they don't even play that game these days, they just get right down to business, don't they? Zoom right past spin the bottle. But we were playing it back then, and, you know, a few boys, a few girls, we were passing around a bottle of my friend's dad's whiskey and spinning the bottle, and the bottle we were spinning landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut. and I did not think that was fair. Now, I still don't think it's fair if you want to know the truth, but every sponsor I've ever had has told me that the fair comes around once a year and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get for fair. So, and it wasn't really that I wanted to become a player either, but I just didn't like the double standard. And already I had begun to bump in. My ideas were bumping into those around me, and I just didn't know how, I didn't understand how to take responsibility for any of this or change or what. So I was confused, and I started to let go of the social life, and I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom. And they all had that magic elixir in there, didn't they? We'd bring stuff from our mother's medicine cabinets and from their liquor cabinets and hang out until after a while. School just didn't work for me anymore. And back then, I felt like my hope was always out on the open road. My favorite place to be then was on my way to somewhere else. I loved that feeling. And I'd get out on the open road, the on-ramps of the 10 coming east and the 101 going north. And I'd hop in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever and be on my way. And I loved that feeling. It felt like the bottle in the glove compartment for me, you know, like I didn't even have to have that thing open to already feel better. And so I'd leave, and because I was so young, I started ending up in some of the Southern California hotspots, like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and L.A. Central Juvenile Hall, and we did that whole dance for a while. And I was always heading for San Francisco. I mean, I loved the idea of San Francisco. I was 12 in 1969, so the 60s were over by the time I got out in the world, but I loved what I thought they were. You know, I'd watch the news, and I watched those people of the 60s. They united. They were tough. They were strong. There was power in what they did. There was power, real power, and they played those beautiful marching songs, and they sang about love and peace and free love. And it just looked so beautiful to me. And all of those people were going to San Francisco, so was I. And my friend and I left one more time. We were 14, and we ended up getting one long ride all the way up into a district called North Beach. And the guy dropped us off right in the middle of this party town. And we looked to my left, and there was Carol Doda in all her neon glory and her flashing boobs. And she was a famous stripper, you know, and at this club. And to my right were hookers and dealers and pimps. Oh my. And we weren't on that street for 10 minutes before a couple of guys approached us, offered us money for sex. And we said yes and did the next syndicated thing. And boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And Dr. Silkworth talks about this in the chapter, The Doctor's Opinion, that after a time we can't differentiate the true from the false. After a while, our alcoholic lives seem the only normal one. And I didn't know it. I couldn't have told you this at the time, but I had already begun to trade away every God-given talent or potential or gift that I had for the effect that alcohol would produce. I wasn't somebody who hated school. I loved school. I thrived. I was good in sports. I loved my family, especially my siblings and my baby sister in particular. I was taking care of her since she was born, and consciously made the choice to leave and jump literally from the frying pan into the fire. And still thinking, I still know it was for me to leave, but I kept thinking that alcohol was my solution. And a year later, I was being admitted to a mental hospital, and this was not a treatment center, it was a mental hospital, and they were not talking to me a lot about alcoholism, they were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child. I was alternately violent and withdrawn and living with a level of frustration down in my gut I did not know how to talk about. And I describe that almost verbatim every single time I talk, because I don't know any other way or any better way to describe myself at that time. It wasn't until I heard Cubby Selby, who I now know was Cubby Selby, early on in my sobriety, he was talking about feeling like a scream looking for a mouth. And I thought, oh, I so get that, you know. But this was not a treatment center, so a lot of my roommates had real illnesses, real manic depression, real schizophrenia, the real thing. Those things are not alcoholism. They stand above, beyond, besides alcoholism. But when I've got no booze and I've got no steps or fellowship or God or my understanding, it takes a little while to sort that out. I look a lot like them. So in the meantime, they're giving me daily nutritional supplements, Thorazine, Melorel, Valium, Dalmain sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I become intimately familiar with 5-point restraints. And that's what I look like at 15. I got busy and crazy all at the same time. I was supposed to be in that nut house for 2 weeks. I ended up being there for a year. It never occurred to me, you know, we hear now, I heard early on when I got to AA that what I came looking for, I came looking with, that what I was looking for was already inside me, but I didn't know any of that back then. I was always looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me. And the trouble with that is that I was always about half a bubble off what it was I thought I saw anyway. You know, like I'd mistake arrogance for confidence, I'd mistake sex for love, I'd mistake brute strength for strength of character. And I get it up in my hot little hands and it dissolves where I stand because it's not it. I had to come to AA to learn that it's when I'm thinking of you, constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. That's what makes that illusion of separation disappear. And I started to say this, and I'll say, I hope I'll finish this thought, and that is that we are not the only people who experience miracles in this world, you know, but I needed this particular kind of miracle. I needed the miracle of being able to be, to treat my alcoholism, to arrest my alcoholism. Not everybody needs that particular kind of miracle. You can go to a cancer support group, and they'll be talking about a whole different kind of miracle. You know, and it's just as valid and just as big and just as frightening, you know, but I needed this one. I needed the sole purpose of, I needed to come in here to learn how to stop drinking and in that learn how to live a life. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is create this launching pad for a life. And anything I've done in over 32 years has been in addition to Alcoholics Anonymous. Added on to it. It's been the first thing I do. My friend Hector says AA isn't the only thing he does, but it's the first thing he does. Me, always. That's what I live as, my foundation. And it seemed a little weak when I got here, too. You know, one of my favorite lines in the book is that what it seemed at first a flimsy reed turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And my foundation has been strewn and built with flimsy reed after flimsy reed after flimsy reed. Like, make that phone call and call that person and get that cup of coffee and go talk to that one and give somebody a ride and stack some chairs and make some coffee and go be kind to your family and go raise my daughter and go to work and bit by bit by bit, flimsy reed by flimsy reed. Answer that phone when I don't feel like it. Show up when I don't feel like it. And somehow those flimsy reeds revealed the loving and powerful hand of God. And it's still here. I still trust. I came to trust it, and now I trust it. It doesn't mean trusting this process either has been a bed of roses. You know, somehow we make the mistake of at least for me, I'll speak for me. But feeling bad on any given day is not alcoholism. It's not necessarily it's a cue that maybe I need to pray and have some faith or something. But grief is God-given. Somebody dies, I'm going to be sad. I'm not working a bad program. I remember getting the flu when I was about 2 years sober and like, you know, like almost freaking out. You know, like, what's wrong? It's the flu. Okay. So, anyway. I ended up, every place I was ever locked up in, when I was a kid, I ended up going over the fence. Except for juvenile hall, the fence was just always a little too high. But by the time I got to the last unit, I was on the unit where they put the patients, they just don't know what to do with anymore. And by the time I got there, I had cast on both of my arms up to my shoulders because I'd been cutting and I was no longer bathing or getting dressed because you don't have to do that to date in a nut house. And somewhere along the line, I had begun to fear that maybe I was just one of those little nut house lifers who gets to get out every now and then, but I'm always, always going to end up back inside. And why? Because every time I hit the street, I was right back doing the very thing that got me locked up in the first place. And I ended up leaving that place, went over the wall to my boyfriend who had been discharged just a couple weeks before. And he was waiting in his car. And I always, you know, I climbed up over the chimney and over the roof and over the gate and jumped down, hopped in his car, and we drove off into happy destiny. And I always find it entertaining to think that I had a boyfriend at the time who found it perfectly normal that he would sit outside the nut house wall and wait for his girlfriend to climb up the chimney and over the roof, to the fence, get in his car and drive away. And we only lasted a couple of weeks, you know. Oddly enough, my probation officer knew exactly where to find me, and it hurt my feelings to find out that, well, he'd called her. And she's right here, come get her. And it just went on like that. And I ended up in a girl's home, and we ended up running away from there. And it's just got to be better over there. And I'm looking for this spiritual cure, and I can't. Everything that I drank and took, trying to access that power, were the very things that were blocking me. And then I get to AA, and I get rid of all that, and now it's just self that's blocking me. And we have steps for that. And the thing that distinguishes our fellowship from another is the first half of the first step. These 12 steps are great. These 12 steps are great. But I think that it's important because there's so much information on Facebook and everywhere. And I would pick up women from treatment centers and things, and I'd say, we're leaving treatment and we're going to AA. There's a difference between recovery. Recovery doesn't necessarily mean you're in AA. You know, how are you? There's a million, you know, a lot of stuff out there. Alcoholics Anonymous is its own way. We don't claim to have the market cornered on how to do it, but it's a particular way. And I just think that's important to say so that we don't blend and mix messages in. You know, I'm not saying either or is right. I know people who have gotten sober in other ways, but I think it's important for me to say that you know, having had this spiritual awakening, this one that lasts, this one that allows me to establish and maintain this conscious contact with this power that I can't describe or comprehend, nor do I need to. But there is never going to be a time where I'm so spiritually fit that I can take a drink of alcohol in any form at all safely, ever. You know, no matter how good I feel 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, I stay here and I work with the newcomers, so I remember that. I don't think there's any better way than to work with a brand new drunk and remember how long that bridge seemed or how high that wall seemed between drinking and thinking about drinking all the time and being sober. And then not just being sober, but really wanting to be sober and really, really having that fun. I was 9 months sober when that obsession to drink alcohol was finally lifted from me. I hope I never take that for granted. It was on me all the time. So my friends and I, we went to Oregon. I was, you know, we're going to get back to the land. Now I'm from Los Angeles, so I don't know what land I thought I was going to get back to, but we were going to get back to the land. And we planted a garden in the front yard, and that's where I learned that in Oregon, when they talked about hoeing, they meant with a tool. It was a whole different thing. And I don't know about you, but I never went anywhere new thinking, let's go screw this up too. I was going to go, we're going to have a fresh start, clean slate. We're going to pay attention. We're going to get it right here. Yeah. And two things happened while I was up there that I certainly couldn't see while it was happening. I couldn't see it till I was looking back. And one was there were days that we would go without drinking. I was a terrible thief. I wasn't going back to lockup. So we'd go without alcohol. And when I had no booze and I had no steps of fellowship or God on my understanding, don't even know about those things yet. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. My relationship with alcohol already so developed that when you take it away for any amount of time, my life quickly becomes your fault. And when I can drink the way I need to drink, I am always overshooting the mark. And that was happening again and still at 17. And our book talks about that too. You know, many of us showing symptoms and signs of alcoholism long before we're ready, willing, or able to do anything about it. Bless you. And I was certainly not ready. And my friends had asked me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot. And, you know, I'm just going to try to skip forward. Suffice it to say that I'm, I'm just one of those drunks who sleeps by the side of the road and calls it camping. You know, I think I'm on a spiritual quest and I'm a hobo. You know, and I'm looking for the kung fu in the middle of all this. And I end up back out on Hollywood Boulevard for just a bit. And I got to talk about this guy for just a minute because I just like the way this laid out. And this guy, You know, I was 18 years old and starting my days off with a pint of pop-up vodka, and I would just go wherever the day took me, and getting out of, in and out of strange cars with strange men doing strange things, and getting rolled out of those cars sometimes and falling down and get up and take a drink and keep moving because nobody cares, and me either. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name, and 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name, but I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my eight-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly that I owed him amends. And I loved it when I got one right, you know, when that, you know, after my family, and after I made that first round of amends to my family at about 9 months sober, which is, again, incidentally, when that horrible obsession was finally lifted, I went looking for this guy because I just, you know, I'd been that proverbial tornado in his life, spiritually, physically, mentally, materially, in every way, and he'd been did nothing but try to help me, and so I went everywhere I knew to look to find that guy, and I just couldn't find him. My sponsor finally said, you know, you got to leave that alone. You got to let that go for a while. You're kind of chasing your tail, and if you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him, you know, in God's time, not yours. Leave it alone. You know, in the meantime, keep doing what you're doing. You're doing well, you know. Keep trying to be a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Go ahead and do that, and you know. And to tell you the truth, when I got here, I did not need a lot of convincing in that direction. I knew that when I got here, you couldn't use the words Carla and good character in the same sentence. I knew that. I knew that I had no self-respect, and I could see that some of you did. But I had not the least idea as to how to go about getting it on any kind of long-term basis. I wanted to be stand-up. You know, I didn't want to be one of those people, and I had seen that in myself over and over. It wasn't like I didn't ever, how many times did I wish I would tell my dad it's going to be different? It's going to be different. It's going to be different. I'm getting it together. I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. And not that I didn't mean it. I just couldn't do it. And I could never stand up and say, I'll be there, and then be there. So, fast forward, right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town. It was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. If I say I'm going to be there, I'm going to be there. And I have not done that perfectly either in my sobriety, but boy, every time I do, I reap the benefits. You know, no matter how scared I am, if I show up, I'm always glad I did. Anyway, I mean, I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. You know what I mean? But don't dare not invite me, right? You got to invite me, but I'm not going. So I show up and I give that talk, and of course I felt better. And when the meeting was over, the thank you line came through, and this man stopped in the line, and he said, hey, where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety and I with almost 13. Only a very well-organized, loving spirit of the universe could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get it done on my own steam, just couldn't do it. And I, you know, that's not the biggest amends story I have. It's not the biggest one you're ever going to hear. You know, it's just, I just like the way that it laid out. You know, when it was time, and I didn't have to do anything except be willing. And there it was. So I took him to dinner, and we had this long talk, and when it was all over, he said, oh my God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive. And he's right. You know, I think if we're in this room tonight, I think we're the lucky ones. Somehow, some way, we've managed to slip through a window of grace one more time to come in here and sit down and recharge and regroup and see what we can go back out there and pack into the stream of life. And I know when I was new, it was much harder. I did not trust this process. I didn't trust it at all. I didn't know. I knew how sick I was, or at least I had an idea. But I didn't know if this was going to be the thing that worked. Nothing else seemed to have worked. You know, and it just feels like, you know, you just get right up against it. And then, like, even at 89 days sober, and I just, I had actually 12-stepped the lady next door to me. You know, she'd been drinking, and I 12-stepped her, and then it looked so good to me that I drank a few days later, you know. You know, that window closed up. I was too busy looking at her. Luckily, I only had to drink for 24 hours. I only had to finish. I had to finish the drunk, but luckily that my sponsor didn't say, "Nope, you drank, you lose." Hung up. You know, she came and she picked me up and helped me throw the bottles away and took me up to the big book study that night. And nobody in that meeting that night said, "Ooh, I smell alcohol in an AA meeting." You know, I wasn't disruptive either, but she, you know, nobody in the room said anything except welcome. And I was not in great shape. You know, they offered me a commitment. And but that was a long time to come. And, you know, my relationships were violent. I ended up having this little girl. We were living, me and my boyfriend were living up in a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon. And we had the baby. And I thought having this baby was going to change the way I drank. You know, I had had enough therapy to know that you got to break the cycle. You got to be the parent you never had and all of that stuff. And you know, now I'm getting my clothes and shoes and the necessities of life out of a box behind a store in town. And I think I'm going to be a better parent than the one I had because I'm delusional. And she got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her up the road where it's got to be better somewhere else. And, you know, I drugged that kid from pillar to post all over three states until she was almost 4 years old, and I was renting a room for my aunt out in a little town called Covina in Southern California, and I had gotten a job in Hollywood. My first legitimate work was in the bar business, and it just seemed to me to make cosmic sense. You know, up until then, I'd been kind of institutionalized. I really couldn't get into the legitimate work arena until then. And it's, you know, it never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? And so one more time, one more job. My daughter's almost 4 years old, and every afternoon I'd kiss her goodbye and I'd take off for Hollywood, which was about 30 miles away. And I'd get thirsty about halfway into Arcadia, and I'd get pull off to Huntington Drive and into the parking lot of the first cabin, and I'd pull in there and I'd have my afternoon shots of Corvo Gold and Bud Bax and get up off the bar stool and go back to Hollywood and pour drinks till the wee hours of the morning with everyone and crawl home and start all over again. I did that like clockwork every day for months. Until one afternoon, I kissed my girl goodbye like I had been doing routinely, got in the car and drove to, headed out to Hollywood and got thirsty again. Same, you know, Huntington Drive, parking lot of the first cabin, pull in there, belly up to the bar, shots of Gold, Bud Bax. And to this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before except for 24 hours. Because I didn't hate the job I was going to, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool this day, and I drank those drinks, and this time I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop long enough. The pull of knowing I had a responsibility at work was not strong enough to get me up off the bar stool. The pull of loving my daughter as much as I did was not strong enough to get me up off the bar stool. So I sat on the bar stool, and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed, and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area until I fell into another job at another dive bar. And I had to stop calling the kid to find out how she was doing because she kept asking me those hard questions like, "Mommy, when are you coming to get me?" And I had no answer for that. And I know that, you know, no matter where we come from, educated, not educated, no matter what color we are, who our daddy is, or any of that, I know we all have a version of this beautiful understatement that Bill writes in the book, and that is, gradually things got worse. We all know what that means. And I married my drinking partner thinking maybe if I made my life look like I thought yours was. And he and I got married about the time we should have split up. We moved indoors. We became the neighborhood entertainment. I told you before, we settled our arguments with a shotgun. Whoever got to the gun first won. And I went to my first AA meeting with black eyes and broken ribs again. Not the first time. Over and over and over again. My friend says it's not the yes that bothered him. It was the, oh no, not again. I got the kid back when she was 8 and a half, and I didn't get sober till she was almost 10. One more Saturday afternoon, we're all at this in our little apartment, our little tiny apartment, and our whole life is just falling apart. It's just sludge. It's just that scrapey little life I'm not afraid I'd die today if I started drinking. Not soon enough. I'm afraid that scrapey little life. That foraging every single day trying to make it through one more day. I'm afraid of that. Or I respect that. One more Saturday afternoon, the cops are in the driveway. The neighbors are watching us. The kid's scared to death. She's standing in the corner. And the cops take the gun. The husband leaves for the last time. It's me and the kid and the booze. And I can't stop drinking. And here's where a hard drinker might take a look at their life and say, you know, I'm really tired of this. A hard drinker would maybe even have to go get a detox for a week. They'll get a little bit of help, come back home, they'd go back to work, have a story to tell if somebody asked them, and then they'd move on with their life. That's a hard drinker. And you find them, you know, you hear them. They say, oh, I couldn't control it really, it was making me sick, I just had to keep, I had to stop, I had to quit. And that's the end of the story. You know, you're waiting for more. That's it. But me, what I did is I pulled, because I'd started drinking beer. The first meeting I went to, I heard the speaker say that she had switched to beer during her drinking career. And since beer's not really drinking, so did I. You know, I thought, the representative from Alcoholics Anonymous seems to recommend it, and it's not really drinking, so. So on that day that the cops were in the driveway and all this happened, I pulled the 12-pack closer to the couch so I don't have to keep getting up for another drink. Because I drank through my circumstances. I drank through drug addiction. I drank through homelessness. I drank through the circumstances of my life. And conversely, through the practice of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship that surrounded me and encouraged me to keep going, there's not been a circumstance in over 32 years that is where the thought that a drink would make any of this any better has not occurred to me. And the obsession surely hasn't. Now, I've heard that it can return, and I've heard it happen to older timers, and not knowing why, they're doing everything they do, just the obsession hits them, but they know how to keep themselves physically safe. You know, and I want to say this too. You know, we talk about white knuckle sobriety, and certainly we want to come to learn the process and learn to trust the process of the steps enough to where they become something where we live comfortably and happily and usefully whole, as our literature says. But if white knuckle sobriety is all you have tonight and you're new, hold on to that. Hold on to your seat. Hold on to us. If that's all you got tonight, get through another day. Come hell or high water. It'll change. If you stick to the process and do what we're doing, it's going to take, it takes effort. Now later in the 10th step it says it's seemingly no effort at all, but that's after we've done all this stuff. You know? We get better. I am not a crazy person at 32 years of sobriety. This works. It doesn't mean I don't have crazy thoughts or that I can't get in a bad mood or that I don't need to reel it back in and practice this 10th and 11th step, 10, 11, and 12, which for me, 10 means 1 through 9. All over again. We just do it again. But there's less and less because I've cleaned up the past and now I'm working with the current, you know, and the recent now. But the book promises that our minds, our thinking will be on a different plane, you know, and so we get better. We get better. I don't know if I can say that enough. I just hear, maybe not here in Atlanta, maybe you don't need that, but I need to hear that we get better and that I'm not being chased around by my old crazy thoughts if I do this work, you know. I do a better step 10 if I'm doing 11, and I do a better 11 if I'm doing 10. And I certainly do a better 12 if I'm doing both of those. So I got to AA, and my first sponsor, she had what I wanted in AA. I didn't like any of her circumstances or any of her statistics or what her religion was or any of that stuff. I didn't care. She was teaching me the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day, and I needed every single one of them for a while. And I was showing up at work and was beginning to pay rent for more than a month in a row. You know, the husband was gone, and now it's on me. And we lived in this teeny little apartment, but it felt like a palace to me. And I couldn't believe, you know, showing up, and it was doing this stuff, and scared to death and happy all at the same time. If my life had been a computer or a television screen, it would have seemed very dark all in the beginning. You know, I mean, that's kind of the metaphor for me, with a couple of pinholes of light. And now today it's mostly light, and there are always some challenges. That's the human condition. We have challenges. We're growing up. So So I took the steps and I made that first round of amends to my family. And to this day, there's not one member of my family who'll stand in the doorway and say, "No, please don't go to the meeting." You know, they never do that. And, then other women started asking me to sponsor them. And I got to tell you, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. Because in your eyes, I see redeemability and forgivability and hope and growth and love where I don't always see it in myself. And sometimes you draw from me conversations I didn't know I needed to have. And I'm a big believer that God doesn't put two people together to help just one. You know, and we draw that from each other. And we're, it's all that me too and uh-huh and yeah. And some and we disclose things to each other on the way to the meeting sometimes, just picking up somebody. I may know you for 15 minutes and yet something happens. After a couple of years, I had you guys, and my daughter didn't have anybody really, and now she's starting to come home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She's been jumped into a gang and starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie on the street where I did. And it's, you know, she's got 18-year-old vatos crawling in and out her bedroom window, and she's 11. And so I had to get her some big help. And from the time she was about 11 till she was 23, you know, there was a long period of reconstruction ahead there for us. She was angry. And one of the most valuable things you guys taught me was how to parent through the guilt. It would have been just so easy to let go and let someone else do it. But I wanted to learn. And it took a while. And I was a child abuser, too. So I had to learn how to keep my hands off my daughter. And that we had to go about this whole thing a whole different way. And so it took a little time. But little by little by little, you know, it worked. You guys taught me mountains are moved a spoonful at a time. And she went to treatment, and then she got out, and we didn't know if she was alcoholic or what, but they told me back then that the gang influence on kids that age was 1,000 times more toxic than drugs or alcohol on kids that age. Why? Because of the I got your back feature, because of the feeling of family. And it was time for me to stop going to 2 and 3 meetings a day and go home and be a mom to that kid after going to a meeting every day. You know, on page 19, they don't hide it in the back. They say it in our book and on page 19 that a more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our homes, occupations, and affairs. And if I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. And so it was time for me to, you know, rearrange a few things and go to work, go to a meeting, go home and be a mom to the kid. She's 42 years old. We just had her birthday party a couple of days ago, and she's... Just a few years ago, I sat with my new husband, who we got together when we were 21 years sober, so hang in there. Thank God our book doesn't say you have to have a boyfriend to be sober, you know. That would have been a long time tapping my foot for that one. But I sat with my husband and my mended family. We watched her collect her master's degree, and she became a social worker. And she's one of those people who goes in the aftermath of things like the San Bernardino terrorist act and the Las Vegas shooting, and she sits with the families and begins to help them put the pieces of their lives back together. That's who she is. And I don't know if she is who she is because or in spite of me, but I know that because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to be part of that, a privileged witness to her life and in the lives of anyone who wants to be in mine. Part of the solution. My grandsons are grown. I got to be part of their lives, and they've never seen me drunk. And the oldest is just finishing his second year law school, and the youngest just moved up to Bend, Oregon to go find his way. And he wants to snowboard and work at Michael's right now and see what's next. He's kind of a designer, and, you know, we'll see what happens there. And my father doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. He sleeps well, and he knows why. And he's been battling cancer and heart illnesses and stuff. He's 85 now, and I just feel good that I'm the one he calls. You know, I'm the one he calls in the middle of the night and helps him make his lists that make him feel better. And that I get to drive him to his appointments and be there for him. Because I, you know... No matter what happened when we were all younger, all of that is different now. And consistency has been really important. When my mom passed away 11 years ago of end-stage liver disease, we were all good. And we had made amends. I come from a family where my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17. My baby brother died of drug addiction and alcoholism when he was 30. And And my last remaining sibling lives in Wisconsin. And when she's not drinking, she's on the Vicodin maintenance diet. So I feel like somehow or other the trapeze just came my way, you know, and I grabbed it and hopped on. And thank God you guys were here. I love these traditions. I love that we have a single purpose here, you know. I just think it's really important that, you know, no matter how spiritual we get, we're never going to be able to safely drink alcohol in any form at all. And I've said that before, but when we go up, I'm running out of time, but when I was 5, I was raped by an intruder, and it was just a big lesson that I learned that, you know what, obviously I'm okay, you know, he was there, and he came into through my kitchen window, and he raped me, and he robbed me, and he was there for a while, and he had a knife, and I survived, but he left, and it turned out that I knew this guy, and I watched him get his wife, he actually got sober 30 days before I did, and so I watched him, you know, I watched him get sober, and his life came together, and then he walked off, and he joined the church, and he left AA behind, and when he went out like that, and what I chose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right to make use of what they offer, this is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my alcoholism. This is where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. I come here and I remember who and what I am, and I can go anywhere I want to and worship. Church is wonderful, no matter what practice or anything you go to. I'm an and person. I think that works and that works and that works, whatever. You know, but it addresses spirituality in a very general way. There's something for everybody in there, which is why it's so beautiful. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we take spirituality and we aim it right at alcoholism. We have one purpose here. One purpose, and that doesn't mean, and, you know, if you don't know if you are here, come to open meetings and find out. But find out, there are about 300 12-step fellowships. And the first half of the first step is not alcoholism for you. Welcome, come to open AA meetings, and then find your place. Find your fellowship, or create your fellowship, and I'll help you. I just feel like that first half of the first step is so important. That's the identification. It's the basis. Dr. Silkworth said it's the basis of our fellowship. One alcoholic talking to another. And if I don't understand what you're talking about, you don't understand what I'm talking about, then we, you know, quickly run out of conversation. Anyway, the purpose of why I'm here, I needed this particular miracle, and I hope that the 12 traditions were called originally the 12 points to assure our future. That this is not just about you and me here and now. It's about our kids and their grandkids and so forth. So anyway, it works. It really does if you work it. And thanks for letting me share with you guys tonight.